through the GRW collapse model, the version of it due to John Bell. And so the ontology was that you have a wave function which each time, and then you also have some way to get local variables. Had I mentioned this word variable previously?
You
come across.
You mentioned it, but you didn't.
Okay.
Joe mentioned it.
Okay. Yeah. It's sort of. It's yeah, John Bell's sort of the things that can be. okay. And then, so we have the ontology, and then also we have the dynamics. The dynamics is that you have Schrodinger evolution. Except that every so often, the system is hit by a jump, and I'm going to go through the jump process in more details in just a minute. And I explained to you how so these jumps are very rare for a single particle. So the jumps, the idea is that the jumps hit. At some very, you know, like once in every so many billion years or something, I think, was it 10 to the, so the suggested idea is that a jump will hit a particle every 10 to the 8 years, so that they don't tend to interfere with quantum predictions for small systems, but for large systems, they very quickly cause collapse, so a pointer will very quickly go into being in one position or the other. You have a question? It's a good question. So a guy called Alistair Ray did an analysis of the GRW model for these superconductors where you can get these squids where you can get a macroscopic superposition of two different states. But when you actually analyze what's happening at the microscopic level in you know, whatever model you use, Cooper pairs or something, it turns out that these collapses don't break the superposition, I think, because they overlap in position anyway. So there's this analysis. I couldn't tell you any more details of the analysis than that. Okay. So so here's how the jump process works. So the probability for unit time of a jump is n over tau. Where n is the number of particles and tau is, in this model, a new constant of nature, a new fundamental constant of nature. And what we really have is we want to have a Poisson distribution so that the probability that we see that we see M events in time T is equal to e to the minus, just copy this expression down, n t over tau is equal to that. And you can check that this is consistent with that. If M is 1, something's wrong here. No, that's right, yep. And T is very small. Okay. Absolutely, yeah, yeah. So this model really only works for some system of particles where you can point to which particle. That's right.
So, if you want to try to mesh it with, say, field theory.
That's right. So one of the criticisms I'll come to later is that it's been very hard for people to give versions of these class models for in the relativistic case quantum field theories, and that's certainly an issue.
Yeah.
I guess because they have a model that works in this case. You can then have jump processes applied to particles. So the next thing is the jump when it happens. And the jump does this. The wave function goes from psi to this expression. Where n, which is the particular particle you want to subject to the collapse, is chosen randomly. Just a flat distribution on that. Have this normalization constraint on this jump operator. This is just is going to hit that. And this normalization here, this appears at the bottom. Is given by this integral Okay, so this is just some mathematical expressions. So we have to say where x comes from. We've said that n is chosen at random from 1 to n, but we also need to choose x. And it's chosen with probability density, I guess. Probability, because this is a like this. So you have some small region in X space, then this is the probability for getting an X in there. And the usual choice for this jump function is that j of x is equal to k, some constant, times e to the minus x squared over 2a squared. Where A is another fundamental constant of nature. That's right, yeah. So you're hitting the, or multiplying the wave function with a Gaussian. If the wave function were initially pretty flat with this, on this scale, then afterwards it'll be a Gaussian. On the other hand, if the wave function is actually smaller than this A scale, since it's inside, then it'll be changed into some different way, perhaps. That's right. So that's the model. And then GRW suggested that tau should be equal to 10 to the 15 seconds. And they suggested that A should be equal to 10 to the minus 5 centimeters. So pretty small on the sort of scale that we wouldn't quite be able to see this, but it's still pretty big compared with quantum phenomena. So if you had a if you have a single particle, which is in some superposition like this, you have two peaks, and the distance between these two peaks is much greater than A. and the size of each of these is much less than A, then every 100 million years, this particle would be subject to subject to a hit, and it would the Gaussian would end up most likely being centered on one of these two sides because you're choosing it. You're choosing the collapse center with this probability, and if it's chosen to be over here at random, then it would end up killing this particular peak. And then you'd multiply this with the Gaussian, so it would be, because this is much smaller than the Gaussian width, I guess, well, it depends on the mathematics, but it shouldn't be changed in shape too much. Oh, and of course, then it would also be renormalized, so it'd be a bigger peak. Because you have the denominator here. Okay, so this would destroy interference, but it happens so rarely that we'd never see it in any experiment. Yeah. Say that again, when you...
So, like, this is talking about, like, systems that's completely separate.
Yeah.
We can always take two Hilbert spaces and just combine them.
Right, separate. Right.
Like, when do we change n from being, like, one to two, and then, start treating these particles as collapses?
So I think this model has the feature, as does the de Broglie-Bohm model, that if you have some subsystem, but the wave function, the total wave function factorizes so that that subsystem is... it factorizes out from everything else, then you can just apply the model to that subsystem. So in the case of the de Broglie-Bohm model, we saw that the guidance equation factorized. Over here, I think it's a fairly trivial consequence of these axioms that you can effectively just apply the collapse to that. On the other hand, if there's entanglement, then you can't do that, and that plays a crucial role in the next thing.
And that's why we don't see large scale objects sitting entangled, because if any particle chair collapses, then every thing collapses.
That's right. Yeah. So I'll go through how that works next. So. Let's imagine we have a measurement. So in quantum theory, we have measurement would look like this. So a particle comes in, hits a detector with a pointer initially in the zero position, then afterwards, assuming this is, this could be a spin half particle, which has some probability of giving either plus or minus outcomes, then afterwards the pointer will go into superposition with these two cases. So to model that in this framework, So this time, if we write these out as wave functions, then we have some function on R1 space corresponding to the system going out in state one. I should put an alpha in here as well. So that's a similar thing. Oh, and then we have all the particles in the pointer which go into some state. Now, actually, I've just drawn this as a big product state, which is just a just an example to see how it works. It wouldn't have, it could be a more entangled state even amongst these degrees of freedoms, but it's sufficient just to make the point to imagine that all these particles are in some big product state. Okay. Is it clear what I'm saying here? So just in terms of actual wave functions, functions of positions, if you could write down a state like this, just imagining that all the particles in the pointer are in some initial state which goes into this state or this one. We can imagine this consists of, for example, a lot of Gaussians that are all tend to be centered around points in the pointer over here. And this one consists of a lot of Gaussians that are all centered around points that are over here somewhere. Okay. So this is just a very simple model. And because these two pointer positions are very different, ignoring the bottom here. Yep. Okay, yeah, ignore it. So because these pointer positions are very different, we can say that the wave functions are non-overlapping. I'm going to come to that, yeah. If the probability of a hit is n over tau, this is the probability per unit time, I guess, of a hit, then whichever particle is hit, you can see that it will collapse away and take away the other term. So if a particle, if this is particle n and it's hit, well, the hit is going to be either over here or over here. If it's over here, then it kills off this expression, and the whole expression will collapse down to the other term. And this will happen randomly. So, you know, with probability, when you look at these expressions more carefully, you see that with probability alpha modulus alpha squared, you'll get this. It collapses into this position, and with probability modulus beta squared, it collapses to this position. So that's how the model works in these two key cases. When you have small systems, you see collapse, but so rarely that you'll never see it in a real experiment. When you have big systems, collapse happens pretty much instantly. And so you'll always have macroscopic objects being in definite states. Yeah, so if order 10 to the 23, then you can see this collapse will happen extremely quickly. Yeah, since you raised it, I'll mention the energy production thing. So the model has some empirical predictions. And these empirical predictions disagree with standard unitary quantum theory. And one is that interference is reduced for large objects. And Penrose has a proposal to see this. Just maybe it's interesting to sketch this quickly. So the idea of Penrose's proposal is that you have a photon comes in and it bounces off, it hits a beam splitter. If it goes this way, it goes up, this is a very big distance, hits a beam, hits a mirror, comes back. If it goes this way, well, en route it hits this very little mirror. This is a very small mirror. That's on a spring. And then it goes, then it bounces off this up to another mirror, which is a very big distance away. So the idea is that the transit time for the photon to go from here, and then back again, should be equal to the time it takes this mirror to bounce and then return to its original position on this spring. So that's a sort of mechanical time. It's quite a big time. You're talking about some reasonable fraction of a second. So this distance has to be very big for the photon. And now, if everything is reversible, if everything is unitary, then what would happen is everything would be reversed. And if you set up the phases appropriately, the photon will just come back out the same way it went in. On the other hand, if you have some collapse, because it's an intermediate time, this mirror would go into a superposition of either having recoiled if the photon went along this path, or having not recoiled if the photon went along this path. So the mirror would be in a superposition. So if something like this is happening, then you would see collapse, and so you wouldn't have reversible dynamics. And so now the sum probability of detecting the particle out here. So this is the experiment that Penrose suggested. And I think he discusses it in the paper that I sent Aggie, so you can distribute that. So the experiment in itself, of course, is very unrealistic. But it has formed the basis for people trying to do interference experiments. There's a sort of whole field, which I think at least partially owes its existence to this proposal of Penrose trying to do nanomechanical quantum interference. So as of yet, as far as I'm aware at least, no one has really done an experiment that would test Penrose's proposal, but it gives you an idea of the kind of experiment that you could use to test this. Yep.
People have done diffraction experiments with like stuff as much as
So I'm sure people have looked at those experiments with this model. I mean, still the number of particles in a buckyball is pretty small, and furthermore, the interference you get anyway, just because these experiments are messy, the visibility isn't very high.
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of problematic. Yeah, so my understanding is that those experiments don't really constitute much of a constraint. And incidentally, even in general, what you're going to do if with these experiments is put constraints on these parameters. And you can imagine sort of in the limit, if tau goes to infinity, or as A goes to infinity, then you just have standard quantum theory anyway. So you want to bound. So these parameters really what you want to do is to push them into a place where they're not doing the job you want them to do. So if it takes longer for an object to collapse than you know our sort of typical perception times of objects, then we would think that it wasn't doing the job. So yeah, these experiments do that kind of thing. The other thing that happens is you get energy production. So if you have some wave function, and then you hit it with a Gaussian, like this, and then afterwards, it's going to be slightly narrower. In other words, it's going to have a higher probability for some higher energies. So it's going to change the spectral, the probability for the different spectral lines of this system. So, for example, if you were to take a hydrogen atom in the ground state and then hit it with this jump process, then there'd be some probability of exciting the atom up to a higher state. And you can do calculations, and you get a number, I think, if you had a mole of hydrogen atoms, the number I think you get is that you'd see something like 10 photons per second. Is that right? Seems like a lot. Anyway. in any case, people have looked at those experiments, but it's actually quite difficult to find systems where this would really be observable, because most of our physical, you know, most of the stuff we have around us is actually very bright. But you can still try to put limits on these parameters from that model. Yeah, so Tom, okay, go ahead. Flat distribution.
Why?
Because they want a set of a model. This is just the thing about this model is it's not really, it's not pretending to be fundamental physics. It's just an attempt to show that you can do this, that exists at least one mathematical model which, in a very limited context, shows you how you can have collapse. You can imagine trying to build a more fundamental model, but this isn't that. This is just a sort of a stake in the ground showing that there exists at least one model that does the job. Yeah. So there's a lot of work done on collapse models, and I'm not really up to date with the literature, so I can't really give you an answer. And people have tried to apply it to all different types of, like, yeah, I don't know the current state of play. Okay. So
it doesn't seem to take gravity or relativity into account.
Right, yeah. So I think there's probably two separate motivations coming in here. The motivation of GLW and Bell, as far as I understand it, was coming from trying to solve the measurement problem. So they just wanted to find a model, no matter how bad a model it was, that they could claim did that. But there's also this motivation coming from gravity, the motivation of Penrose and Diossi that I gave yesterday. But you're right, there's no sense in which this model is attempting to use that idea to build the model. And there may be work out there that takes the idea more seriously. I'm not enough of an expert in this. Okay. So let me carry on. So I mentioned that you need to provide some way of getting local bubbles. And there's two ways of doing that. So the idea is that you want to point to that aspect of the ontology which is responsible for the appearance of the three-dimensional world. There's been two suggestions. So one is the flash ontology. And the idea here is that you have all these jump centers. And during some typical process, there'll be lots of these little flashes, you can think of them, corresponding to these jump centers. And they live in three-dimensional space, because they're all, you know, have an X associated with them. And if you have a macroscopic object, there'll be quite a lot of these jumps going on. So the idea is that they form your local bubbles. And then the other ontology is the mass density ontology. This is Girardi. And two collaborators. In 1995. This was from Bell in 1987. The idea is a bit heuristic, but here's the idea. You define this mass density operator. They use this kind of this sort of operator notation. You should just think of this as the number operator for the number of particles of type k. Imagine you have different lots of different types of particles, electrons, whatever, all sorts of different particles. This is meant to be the number operator for particles of type k. In a volume of size A, centered at x. So if you accept this kind of heuristic way of thinking, then you can define this object, and it gives a mass density. And it's a local mass density in three-dimensional space. So this, in this approach, is the local variables. I think what's interesting about this, I don't think either of these proposals are that great, but I think the idea that you should think about what it is in the model that corresponds directly to the three-dimensional appearances of the world is an interesting idea.
So in the mass density ontology, then the mass densities that we observe would be continuous functions, right?
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
So how would they explain maybe think about this more, but it seems strange that we wouldn't, if I send a single particle through a double-slit experiment, why wouldn't I expect to then get, to just kind of see the smeared-out interference?
Yeah, so in that case, the mass density would be some funny smeared-out thing. It would be, the particle going through the interferometer would be smeared out in both, according to this ontology. But when you go to macroscopic objects, you'd lose that smeared out, and that smeared out quality, and it would always be sort of, the point would always be in one position or another.
So they would then explain the single particles in double-slit experiments by some kind of, by a collapse in the screen.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So it's okay if the ontology is weird in places we don't directly see, but we want it in the macroscopic world to correspond to the sort of things we believe the world to be like. Yeah. That's the idea. But one problem with this flash ontology, it works okay for the GRW model because you have these jumps, but there are continuous collapse models. Where instead of having, instead of hitting the thing with a jump every so often, you have a continuous process. So Philip Pearl has pioneered the continuous collapse models, and so this just wouldn't apply to that case. How am I doing? Okay, so I should end with a few criticisms. So here's a funny criticism. We have these tails. So when you hit the wave function with this Gaussian jump operator, although you pretty much collapse the wave function to be over here, there's still going to be a tiny bit of it left over here. Very small. And the same is true when you get these big macroscopic objects as well. There's still going to be a very small part of the wave function left over here. But now if you apply if you apply this kind of thinking that we applied in the many worlds model, then we'd say, well, this, if the wave function is a real thing, then you have all the structure of, you know, these sort of zombies and mindless hawks living over here. That's what the zombies. And so why aren't they real? You haven't actually killed the zombies. It's hard to kill zombies, I suppose. You could argue that the flash ontology tries to resolve this problem because the flashes will predominantly occur over here. But you still have this argument, this sort of functionalism argument, saying, well, if something is real, then it's real, and you can't sort of not ascribe reality to it if you, reality to it if you've admitted it into your ontology. Why don't we? Well, according to this argument, that there is some sort of part in this ontology that is happening over there. So this is a criticism of the model. I think it's a serious criticism, even though on the face of it looks kind of crazy, because this can have a very, very small amplitude.
Couldn't you just solve, we just chose J of X to be a Gaussian. It's Gaussian.
Right.
It's easy to work with, but couldn't we?
Yeah, choose some...
just change your model and pick something with compact support that would fix that problem?
Yeah, maybe that's possible. I imagine that it would be pretty ill-defined mathematically. I suppose that's why it doesn't work. Or at least it would behave in a bad way, let's say. Certainly in non-relativistic quantum theory, if you do that, then things are just going to blow up straight away. But maybe that can be done, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't have to be like a function. It could just be something that's, like a bomb function.
Right. Yeah, that might do it. Yeah, I don't know if... I mean, there is a literature on these tails. If you search on GLW and tails, you'll find papers on this. And I don't know if they've tried to solve that problem in that way. It's hard to make this model, the second criticism is it's very hard to make this model relativistic. So in the case of the many worlds approach, this isn't really a problem. You just take relativistic quantum field theory and you have, you know, you can evolve a state still in time. So you can get you can then just apply this sort of this effective reasoning and get to the many worlds approach. In the case of the de Broglie-Bohm model, it's more of a challenge, but people have built quite convincing relativistic models of quantum field theory in the case of the de Broglie-Bohm model. But here there have been attempts in this direction, but it's proved much more difficult to do. And then the third criticism is something we discussed a little earlier, is that it's a very effective heuristic model. It would be nice to have a fundamental model of this nature. Okay, how am I doing for time? So I thought I was going to get time to move on to a new subject, but that's not going to happen. So let me just finish with a few questions, a few issues. Actually, out of curiosity, do people have, of these different models, do people have, I've presented three explicit models, the many worlds, the de Broglie-Bohm, and the collapse. Is there a preferred model? So how many people could even give an answer to that question? One. Two.
In terms of like what we believe in?
What we prefer, and you can have whatever reasons for preferring one to the others as you wish. Is that just two people who could give an answer, right?
I quite like the
okay, so... don't like many worlds, yeah. Do you have a preference at this stage? Or? Yeah, okay. Just getting people to pre-declare that they would declare.
I just think that in this model, I'm deploying more models. Just add some stuff, it seems arbitrary.
Mm.
In many worlds, you don't add anything
Right. Right.
And it seems to work. So why would everybody all come to us?
Which is the simplest solution, which is infinitely many other.
No, Occam's razor doesn't mean you have to. The simplest solution, only the solution with the minimum number of entities. So in these models, you add all these new constructs.
I mean, it's true that you're not adding anything to the mathematics, although the ontology kind of gets.
I was going to say I just like this this model because this one is just because it's got like these predictions about interference with large object being reduced and conserving energy, and then I realize wait, I'm criticizing the model because it's not making predictions that can be backed up experimentally.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, it's a good thing that it makes predictions. Yeah. Exactly. That it could be falsified in using Popper's terminology. Yeah, yeah. So okay. So we got your many worlds.
Just among these three.
Among these three. Yeah. No. Sure. There's a whole infinity of other. Well, infinity. But a large finite number of other approaches that I haven't discussed. And do you, Tom? Did you? No, you didn't clear. Okay. Right. And then who else had declared, Elon, you'd said?
I agree with the argument that the Pepperly bomb model is just the many worlds in disguise, so I don't really have a preference between those two. I think it's just a matter of convenience in thinking or calculation.
Yeah.
I don't like this collapse model.
You don't? So you don't have a preference or your
between the Pepperly bomb and many worlds.
Okay. That's
the same.
But it sounds like you support many worlds in over Jabari Bound because you buy the disguise argument.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And who are you were declaring or
I
just
don't like any of those three, but I do sort of like cubism.
Cubism, right. Okay, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I wish I'd had time to cover that, but I think I'd do a bad job because every time I try to say anything about cubism, Chris tells me I got it wrong. So I'm sort of worried about actually saying. Maybe I should just air one of the videos of him talking about cubism and leave it at that. Well, I can't. Other people seem to be more successful. Yeah. Did anyone else declare? Did you? No, just curious. No. No, that's right. I haven't done those yet. Yeah. Are there any models out there that people prefer to the ones I've discussed? Just if you're asked, there are people who studied. I mean, presumably, you mentioned cubism, but any? Just curious. Okay. I suppose I was about to sort of declare, but I'm not in a very comfortable way. But
I'm attracted to. I'm not actually sure that I've seen an explicit model for it, but I'm attracted to something that has sort of the ontology of de Broglie-Bohm. A more stochastic method of evolving the trajectories.
Right. There have been models like this, Vigier, which wrote some models like this. And of course, there's also importantly the mine's just gone blank. Nelson Dynamics. So that's exactly a model like this. But there are some technical questions about the Nelson approach. So it's exactly that you have trajectories, but they're kind of stochastic. And there seems to be a claim that you can get these trajectories without making the wave function real. The wave function isn't playing an ontological role. But then there's something called the Wallström objection that there seems to be a technical problem with the approach.
Is Nelson the one that draws the analogy between Schrödinger's equation and Brownian motion?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly that. Yeah. Yeah. So it's an approach out there. And Lee Smerlin has done some follow-up work on that approach. He knows that approach much better than I do. He's actually read the papers and so on. Yeah. I don't really know which of these approaches, if any, I like. But here's a sort of issue the point I made at the beginning, which was that that really. That this may just be an academic exercise, and we need to get to the next fundamental theory before we can make progress on these interpretational issues. But here's, imagine we had quantum gravity, and this could be a theory that looked very different from any of the physics we have now. You know, just as Einstein's general relativity looks extremely different from Newtonian physics, that just the mathematical way you write it down, everything, it's a very different kind of mathematical theory. But still, it's possible in that example to take a limit to Newtonian physics and extract Newtonian physics, and then the theory ends up looking in a particular way. In fact, one way of doing it is this sort of Newton-Cartan approach, where you end up having curvature in space. So not space-time, but space. So there is actually a theory that sort of, if you take general relativity and take the limit as c goes to infinity, then you get this Newton-Cartan. Approach, which has curvature of space, but not curvature of space-time. So it's a sort of a theory that you can actually investigate. And in some sense, the best interpretation of Newtonian physics, of the Newtonian gravitational physics at least, is this, because it's the right limit. So there's a question, what would be the, if you were to take general, if you take quantum gravity, whatever that's going to be, and then take some limit, which version of quantum theory is the thing that you'll have here? And at this stage, my disposition is to say that it will be the collapse approach. I think the Penrose argument for collapse is quite compelling. And so that I think that my own, if I'm going to declare, I'd say this is the right thing. On the other hand, there's a problem. Now, if you look at Newton-Cartan approach, it really misses out a lot of what's interesting about general relativity. There's a lot going on here. And I suspect in the case of quantum theory, it'll be even worse. I suspect that that it will be really the collapse. If I'm right, and the collapse is the appropriate limit, that there's a lot of interesting stuff happening here that just isn't represented there. So my feeling is that in some ways it's too early to interpret quantum theory. Well, not this explicit model. No. I mean, just some more general. Just that the collapse would happen. That there'd be something in the ontology corresponding to wave function collapse.
Yeah.
I don't mean the Copenhagen interpretation. I think that my hope is that ultimately we'd have a realist interpretation of nature, so we'd have some actual ontology that we can talk about in a sensible way. Anyway, it all remains to be seen. Okay, so I'll stop there. Tomorrow I'm going to talk a bit about some of these issues arising from sort of epistemic approaches to quantum theory. And I may also go on to the Koch and Specker proof, which is a demonstration that quantum theory has this odd contextuality property, something very interesting.